Thank you. Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in 030526, Mack Trucks, Inc. versus Elizabeth Tamez.
May it please the court. Your honors, along with Rob Galloway, I'm Sean Green. I represent the petitioner in this case, Mack Trucks. This case presents two material issues to this court today. First, is a trial judge's hands tied, and is that judge forced to give somebody who's lost a Robinson challenge a rehearing, a second bite, sometime before an appeal? Second, in a case where a Robinson challenge is granted and a trial judge finds when a party admits the expert was unreliable, when that expert does not show methodology, when in fact that expert does not rule out with reasonable certainty other alternative causes of an event in this case, is it an abuse of discretion for that trial judge to have excluded the causation opinion? Because, Your Honors, the 13th Court of Appeals incorrectly, respectfully we submit, got the answers wrong to those questions, this court ought to reverse and reinstate the dismissal of this case, the summary judgment.
Let me be sure I understand. Do you think the outcome is different if we consider the bill of exceptions or not?
Your Honor, I don't. I don't think it's different. I do think it has material effects, although, Justice O'Neill, I don't think I'll tell you the sky is falling. It will have an impact on trial judges and what goes on in courts around the state, but it will not impact, I don't believe, this court's ultimate analysis. And the reason is because Mr. Elwell, even in the second bite hearing, which is about 60-some-odd pages long, although he did a little bit better job of showing his methodology, what he didn't do, even in the second hearing, was rule out the cargo, the 8,000 gallons of crude oil, highly volatile, as a potential source of the fire. So that answers, Judge, your question. The outcome will be the same. But the problem is, and it goes to the first problem really before the court today, which is when you have a scenario where, as in this case, multiple parties were sued, including several that were involved in the tank, which is now essentially disavowed as a cause of the fire. Those parties settled out and left only Mack, the manufacturer of this truck, left to go to trial. The truck was 10 years old at the time of the accident, by the way. The record substantiates that through the accident report and the other testimony. So Mack is the only one left. They're on the eve of trial. Mack has filed a motion to exclude the expert, in this case, who's not only the product liability expert from a liability sense in terms of here's what the defect is, here's what I think the problem is.
Well, that's kind of what I want to know procedurally. I have not yet looked at the record. You said this was on the eve of the trial. Was there order in place, a scheduling order?
Not that I'm aware of, Judge. This motion was set, and what you'll see when you get into the record is, at best, it's convoluted in terms of what was heard when and how it shook out. Although it is convoluted procedurally, the issues come out being very simple.
Well, then, in the order setting the hearing on your motion to exclude the expert's testimony, did the trial court advise the plaintiff's counsel that this was your only shot? You know, come loaded for bear because this is the only time you're going to get...
Your Honor, I can't say that it did. I don't know. I don't believe anybody's ever claimed either way in this case. The plaintiffs have never argued in this case, oh, well, we were unfairly ambushed, or the trial judge didn't give us the procedural due process or the procedural rights we needed, which would potentially be a different story. The United States Supreme Court has addressed that in the Kumho case and said, you know, there's two areas where the court needs to give trial judges a great deal of deference in the expert sense. One is in the procedural settings. When are you going to have this hearing? How's it going to be vetted? Is it going to be written or oral? And your question goes to that, Your Honor, because the Supreme Court has said, even though you have discretion, trial judge, you have to be careful. You can't do it in such a manner that it's unfair and people can't fairly present the facts.
When would it be an abuse of discretion not to give them a second chance?
When would it be an abuse of discretion?
The standard would be abuse of discretion.
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
And so would there ever be a circumstance where it would be abuse of discretion?
Yes, there would, Judge.
It would be
an abuse of discretion if, for instance, in Justice Owens' hypothetical, what happened was, in essence, the trial judge said, by the way, you have 3 days to get your expert down here. If he's not down here and I don't hear him live, then too bad. You can't submit anything in writing. I'm not going to listen to anything. That type of thing has come up before in the federal court context, and the Supreme Court has said, not directly addressing it on review, but has said, procedurally, you do have to be fair. There can't be a manifest error procedurally that forbids somebody from bringing that evidence. That didn't occur here. What occurred here was there was a written motion filed by Mack. There was some type of response filed by the respondent in this case, and then the judge had a full-blown oral hearing. And it's important.
Well, but I mean, we don't have a standard by this case, or is there by any other, about what fire experts, accident reconstructionists involving fires, standards they have to meet. I'm unaware of any case on that. Are you in Texas?
I'm not aware, Judge. There is not that I know
so
of a case.
So you come down, you think your guy's going to meet it. You come down, and the judge says no. Since it's a case of first impression, shouldn't you get a second chance to try to meet, since it was unclear whether all analytical gap or some part of the Daubert factors would apply?
I don't believe so, Judge, and I think particularly in this case, Your Honor, I'll tell you why. It's because there is no scenario here that the plaintiffs are arguing, well, we just didn't know what our burden was, the respondent in this case. You're right, there isn't an exact litmus for a fire expert. In fact, in most scenarios, there's not an exact litmus for what the expert has to testify to. We have on the one hand Robinson, which has the factors that can be applied, and then we have Gamble on the other, which is, you know, allegedly the beekeeper standard, and if you're testifying just on experience. In this case, the respondents have said, well, our expert is so good, he satisfies both. He's not only the beekeeper, he's also the aeronautical engineer. And if you will, Your Honor, what this case is, I think, paraphrasing Justice Hexum's language you had recently in the Race Ipsa products case, this is sort of like Robinson Light. And I don't mean that in a flippant way. I mean that's what the Supreme Court, and I believe this court respectfully, envisioned when you have a case that may be a little bit different than some
other.
Well,
that's substantively, but procedurally, we have not nailed down, we've so far intentionally not passed any rules. It's okay, here's how you're going to handle experts. And I guess my question would be, should we treat this motion for reconsideration like a motion for continuance of the summary judgment hearing? How procedurally should we judge what the trial court did?
I do, Your Honor. I think that would be a valid analogy. I think what you need to do procedurally is treat it in terms of, number one, you start with the presumption of the trial judge has great deference in deciding when he is going to set the hearing and what type of hearing it would be. Using your analogy, it would be just like the trial setting and, for instance, discovery under Level 3. The trial judge has great discretion in managing his docket. This court has said that, or her docket, over and over before. So
is
when
it
you
like amending a deposition or supplementing the deposition or reopening the evidence at trial? Is it like those things, or?
Judge, in a sense, I suppose it would be, except that I think the standard needs to be higher than simply amending a deposition. Obviously, if you're just going to amend the deposition, there's ways you can do it under the rules. But in this particular case, the reason the courts have articulated, this court, the Supreme Court, that you give so much deference to a trial judge in the procedural manner is because you want finality. You want the balance between a judge being able to manage his or her docket and moving forward on a case if the facts merit it.
But until recently, we didn't have these hearings.
True.
These decisions were made in the course of the trial. And if you thought you had a pretty good leg, you just went on. But if you thought overnight, I might not have done so well with that witness yesterday, maybe I better try to put him on again, see if I can't get a little more out of him. And you know, that's a pretty loose standard when you can do that and when you can't.
Right, Judge, Your Honor, which is why I'm telling you, I think it's different in this scenario. And I think the General Electric versus Joyner and Kumho Tire out of the United States Supreme Court have peripherally addressed that and said this is a much more serious scenario because in your example, respectfully, Your Honor, the trial judge is not making a gatekeeping decision as to the witness necessarily, whether he will or she will or won't testify. That's what's happening in this case. So there isn't any reason, and there's been no complaint made by the respondent in this case, that somehow they were surprised, that somehow they didn't have the opportunity. In fact, I think, Your Honors, what's very telling in this case is not only did the respondents concede four different times.
Well, okay, but you started out by saying the outcome's no different whether you consider the Bill of Exceptions or not. So do we really need to address the discretionary piece?
Yes, we do, Judge, and I'll tell you why. You need to address it because the way that the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals set this up is as follows. They considered the evidence that was put in on the record at the actual live hearing, which, by the way, did not include the deposition testimony of this witness other than the portions the MAC counsel read into the record. Okay, the record, the court's record will reflect that. So the court had the live testimony. Corpus Christi Court of Appeals said they considered that. But then the Corpus Christi Court also said two times in the opinion, I believe on page 8 and then on pages 12 and 13, that they explicitly considered the evidence in the bill of exception. What does that mean, and why should this court address that?
Well, wasn't that same evidence proffered in response to the no evidence summary judgment motion?
It was not. It was not, Your Honor. It was different evidence. And what I've done is very briefly charted out some of it to give you an example of what it would be. For instance, if you look at the record, and I believe it's volume 3 of the reporter's record where Mr. Elwell originally testified, there's about 9 pages of very conclusory type opinions that he gives on the case. You look at the second hearing, where Mr. Terry, one of the plaintiff's attorneys, was putting him back up on the bill of review, there's 60-some-odd pages. And they do a better job of showing methodology, if you want to use that term, in terms of how he came up with some of his opinions, although my contention in the answer to Justice Heck's question would be they never did the ultimate job of ruling out the cargo.
What was the cross-examination in the bill of exceptions like?
The cross-examination, the bill of exceptions, was very similar to the cross that was put on earlier. It was that he asked questions about the O'Day and the Maryland study and what he had done.
In your experience, is it typical that there would be a full adversarial hearing in the bill of exceptions or not?
I've done several, Justice, and some there have and some there haven't. I mean, to be candid with you, in my experience, nothing is really typical in any of these Robinson
cases. If we say that there is that the trial court abused its discretion in this case, wouldn't that make all bills of exceptions full adversarial trial-type hearings, as if the evidence were coming in?
It sure could have that effect, Your Honor.
I mean, isn't the other way that a bill of exceptions works is, okay, the trial court has ruled on the admissibility of this evidence. We're going to put on a bill. We don't need cross-examination, Judge. This is going to take. We're just trying to make a record to show the Court of Appeals what the evidence would have been. It lasts a short amount of time. There's no cross-examination. There's really no back and forth between counsel. Isn't that how it can work, at least?
Typically, Your Honor, a bill would work like that. Rarely do you have cross-examinations on a bill. In fact, sometimes people just make informal bills, which I believe the rules allow.
But if we were to hold the trial court abused its discretion in this case, under these circumstances, wouldn't that do away with that type of bill where there is not this adversarial setting?
I believe it could. It could easily have that effect. And more also appropriately in this case, too, Your Honors, the effect it could also have is a chilling effect, an over-the-shoulder effect on trial judges who are in the trenches. So the example would be this. You have a trial judge who conducts a full Robinson hearing like this. 2 days. First day has all that tells everybody, you can put whatever evidence you want in on this record. And they do. Then has the next day where he discusses and asks questions and things like that. Your Honor, the idea that you then have a bill that can be reviewed for the first time by a court of appeals to see if a trial judge abused his discretion then makes the court of appeals the gatekeeper. That is the effect. Because,
well, again, procedurally, did this hearing took place before you had a motion for summary judgment on file?
There was a motion on file, but it wasn't a no evidence motion. It's very confusing.
Well, was there a motion aimed at causation on file?
Not a no-evidence motion, Judge.
Well, any motion.
Yeah, there was motions to dismiss the case on file, yes.
But did it go to causation?
I believe it did. I think they had several categories, including the ones that are sort of the tail end of the ones that are on appeal.
When this hearing took place, before the hearing took place, was it clear to the plaintiff's counsel that this testimony can't be used for any purpose, not for summary judgment? This is your one shot at it. And this witness lives or dies in this case henceforward based on this hearing.
Well, it was as clear, Judge, as to anybody who's going into a Robinson hearing. You don't ever know what opinions the judge may find that are unreliable, especially when you have an expert that's hitting
the
off.
But did they know that was at risk? In other words,
I believe they did, and I'll tell you why, is because when you look at the record, the counsel for respondent told Judge Benales, Judge, if you strike this expert, that does me in on the summary judgment. In fact, now that I think of it, technically everybody thought there was a summary judgment pending because they argued it, but what it turned out to be is Mac's counsel at the time hadn't actually filed it, or there was some confusion about it, so it wasn't technically pending even though they argued it and the judge granted it.
What specific evidence is in the bill that was not proffered at the original Robinson hearing or in response to the no evidence summary judgment motion?
I've done, Your Honor, just a very cursory one. I'd be happy to give you an even more thorough one than this. But, for instance, what I took was the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals when they said, here's what we've looked at from Mr. Elwell in the bill and in the thing. For instance, witness statements and demos. In the first hearing, the only mention of anything was of Mr. Harrell, who was a pastor.
Let me ask you about that, Mr. Harrell. Why is that not enough in and of itself for him to say that I know the difference between diesel and crude by sight and smell, and I got there right after this happened, and Mr. Tamez was covered with diesel fuel, and looking at the diesel burn marks on the road, why is that not enough to provide reliability for the opinion that this was a diesel fire?
Number one, it's speculative. Number two, I don't believe he talks about the burn pattern in terms of where the fire started. Number three, Mr. Harrell concedes that he's assuming a number of these things. And number four, it doesn't rule out that the fire started in the cargo, the 8,000 gallons of crude. Okay, Mr. Harrell came upon the scene minutes after it happened. And important is, and not totally cited within the briefs, if we look at Mr. Harrell's deposition testimony, is that he testified that the cargo trailer, the roof, the hatch was open and flames were coming out of it when he got to the scene. Mr. Harrell does not offer a scintilla of evidence as to that there was a product defect that caused or was producing cause of this particular event.
Mr. Breen, you make a lot of arguments in your brief and made a lot of arguments today about why Mr. Elwell's testimony is not admissible. Is your principal point, however, that he failed to exclude the cargo as the cause of the injury?
Yes.
Is that your principal point?
Yes, Your Honor. That is one of the two principal points that makes his opinion unreliable, and therefore, under an abuse of discretion standard, judgment analysis should be upheld.
And the other principal point?
He did not state and show his methodology for how he came to his opinions that were rendered in the first hearing.
You don't like the fire triangle, then?
Well, Your Honor, it's not that I like it, and I certainly don't dispute it, but Your Honor, it's not methodology. Fire triangle is like, it would be akin to me telling, Your Honor, well, I'm an expert in people who fall off of towers. And by the way, I base my experience on Newton's law, and I know there's gravity on Earth, so I can tell you why this person fell off a tower. Okay, it's a principle of physics, sure. Everybody knows that you need oxygen, fuel, and ignition. But it applies equally to the cargo in the trailer and a number of other places. So sure, it's a sound principle, but it's not a methodology.
Well, I'm a little bit confused on the exclusion piece, failure to exclude other possible causes, because it seems to me that if you, presuming you had reliable testimony that the fire started here, doesn't that in and of itself exclude other possible causes? If you say, I've looked at it, I'm reliable, this is what started here, and here's why I think it does, then why doesn't that exclude the alternate cause right there?
Because I believe this court told us, Gamble, it's not enough just to say, have the reasoning. I've concluded in my mind that one thing was the cause of this event, therefore there can't possibly be other causes. You have to identify and analyze separately the other causes and show a methodology that rules them out with a reasonable certainty. Otherwise, all you would have to do as an expert, Your Honor, would be to say, I've determined what the cause of this fire was. It therefore can't be any other cause.
But you can undermine those other studies. I mean, I think it was the O'Day study that they apparently concluded that all cargo, whether it's fuel or not, tends to be the source of fires. So, I mean, can't you just cast doubt on it?
You can, Your Honor. I agree with you. I'm not here taking the position that either the Maryland study or the O'Day study shows as a matter of law that Mr. Elwell was wrong. Nor was it Mack's burden to do that. It was not Mack Truck's burden to prove that the Maryland study or the O'Day study conclusively proved that it couldn't have been the ignition or the fuel system in the Mack truck. It was the respondent's burden to exclude with reasonable certainty other things. And the reason the Maryland study and the O'Day study got such heavy play is because if you look at Mr. Elwell's, for instance, the excerpt from the reporter's record, pages 68 and through 70, you'll see exactly what the trial judge saw in this case, which was an expert who took the stand not only at his deposition but in front of the trial judge and said, I don't have to show you my methodology. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but I have provided that exact snippet to the court. He said, gatekeeping is for the judges. If the judges want methodology, they need to figure it out. That's what Judge Bonales was looking at. So the question isn't, does the O'Day or the Maryland study give us some pause to think, well, maybe Mr. Elwell could have possibly been correct. The question has to be, did Judge Bonales abuse his discretion when he decided, as a gatekeeper, that this expert wasn't playing by the rules, did not state his methodology, and was giving an unreliable opinion? And, you know, respectfully, Your Honor, what Judge Bonales excluded wasn't all of his opinions. He excluded his opinions on proximate and producing cause. So it wasn't as if he just shotgunned the whole thing. He clearly used a scalpel. He didn't throw the entire event out.
Did you object to the bill of review?
Your Honor, I believe that initially, I wasn't trial counsel, and I'm trying to think, and I want to answer you accurately, so I'm going to tell you I don't know. I doubt it because trial counsel asked questions during the bill, so effectively, you know, I just don't know the answer to be able to tell you accurately.
Important enough point that you probably would have searched for it and brought it out if you had.
I think so, Judge. I mean, Your Honor, because important is that what Mack did say at the beginning of that hearing was, which, by the way, akin to the question before, was really more of a surprise because they show up, they're getting ready to argue a motion for summary judgment, all of a sudden it's the plaintiff saying, Judge, we're back here, we've got our witness back from Phoenix or wherever he was from, we'd like to make a bill because he didn't give you the good methodology the first time. And I realize that now respondents don't want to embrace the four times, at least on the record, that they admitted Mr. Elwell didn't provide methodology. They say, oh, well, we were just saying that. We didn't really mean that. We were just trying to give Judge Bonales an easy way out. Well, Your Honors, I believe that when you tell...
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents. The marshal will add 8 minutes to the respondent's time.
May it please the court, Mr. Glenn Boudreau and Mr. John Sanger represent argument for the respondents. Mr. Boudreau will open with the first 16 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court. I represent two of the respondents in this case. Mr. Sanger represents the balance and will split time. I have to respond very quickly to something that was said right toward the end of the petitioner's argument because I think the mischaracterization of Mr. Elwell's testimony at any point in this trial, live or by affidavit, is just rife in this record. To suggest that Mr. Elwell ever said that he didn't have to present any methodology to the court simply misstates the record. That's, I am sure, without looking at it just now, as I heard that repeated again, that that was in response to a question where Mack Trupp's trial counsel was trying to get Mr. Elwell to admit that he didn't follow the rationale set out in the Maryland study, which Mr. Elwell considered an irrational approach to this case. Now, those kind of suggestions have been made over and over throughout the briefing from the day that we started the first Robinson hearing at the trial court all the way through this court. The fact of the matter is, I think it would be helpful to the court if the court understood just what happened at the Robinson hearing, initial Robinson hearing.
Let me just ask you a more fundamental question. What is it about Mr. Tamez being covered with diesel fuel that indicates the fire started in the fuel system?
Well, the contest in this expert witness case was whether or not the crude oil at the trailer was the source and origin of the fire which took Mr. Tamez, or whether diesel fuel was, which was located at the tractor. Simply stated, Justice, if there is diesel on Mr. Tamez, that indicates that the diesel tanks lost integrity at some point in this process, probably during the rollover event.
Is that enough to get you to the jury?
How do you tell where the source of ignition was?
Well, you look to see if there are ignition sources, first of all, both at the tractor and then at the trailer. The trailer is simply being pulled by the tractor. The tractor is number one, operating hot services, very hot services, through its engine and various manifolds and so on. Secondly, is carrying a battery pack within 3 inches of the diesel tank that fuels that tractor. There's nothing back at the trailer that is going to ignite crude oil, much less any other substance that's flammable.
Certainly not. How fast was the truck going?
Your Honor, the trooper estimated that, well, first of all, the trooper said it was
just roughly
28 to 32.
And the rollover is on a highway?
This was on a county road where the suggested curve speed, as Mr. Pam has entered this curve, was 30 miles an hour.
And a tractor-trailer rolling over, there's not going to be any sparks from anything other than the battery?
Well, I wouldn't ever say that. I think you're looking for the most likely sources.
Well, I mean, that's what the jury can't just guess.
No, Your Honor, one of the things that came out subsequent to the first
trial. That's what we decided in Ridgeway. You got a fire in a truck, that doesn't mean you win. You got to show a defect and that the defect was the cause, which would seem to me eliminating the fact that you've got a giant tractor trailer skidding, rolling down the highway, metal on the roadway. There's not going to be any sparks. How are you going to eliminate
Well, those? I think the question, look, there are a number of ignition sources, possible ignition sources. If you're just to list all of the ignition sources that may be the actual igniter in any given accident, rollover, T-bone crash, whatever it may be, there are going to be a whole range of ignition sources, including sparks from the friction of this machinery rolling over, in this case into a dirt.
And how are those eliminated by your expert?
Well, you look for the most probable ignition source, the most likely.
Which just happens to be the one defendant that's left.
Well, you know, I don't think that's taking a fair view of Mr. Elwell's task or the job that he.
I mean, we didn't in Daubert suggest, well, we can't figure out, you know, Bendectin's more probable than anything else we can imagine. I mean, you've got to prove it was Bendectin. That's what Daubert was about.
Well,
don't you have to prove? I mean, you can't.
I don't understand that to be the test, Your Honor. Maybe I misspeak. But
well, what,
I think
what
the
evidence?
Test is whether or not, not whether the trial judge is convinced by the expert, by the expert's opinion and conclusions, but whether or not that opinion seems to have a reliable basis.
Well, we're down to the ignition source. Isn't that really where we are?
Absolutely, which is why the trailer is almost always excluded if you're looking at probable and likely ignition sources.
Well, the eyewitness who said he got there within seconds after he heard the crash, and he saw the tank on fire and the cab on fire. So how, from those two facts, how can anybody say, well, it's more likely than not that the fire started first in the cab and then the tank? What is in the record that's there's a methodology?
At least two things, yeah. First of all, there's a clear diesel spill print that is left on the ground that Mr. Elwell talked about.
But that doesn't indicate a fire ignition source. That there's diesel on the ground and diesel that burned and diesel on Mr. Pandas doesn't indicate that was the source of the ignition.
Well,
it's the source of the spill, but not an ignition source.
Well, first of all, nothing spilled out there that didn't burn. I understand, but
we're trying to get at that the source of the ignition is more probable one than the other.
That's right. Probably, as I say, I think there are a number of ways to answer that question. Probably to me, the most persuasive is Mr. Pamez is in the cab with the tractor. This is not a violent rollover. This is a low speed half roll on the cab's part, three quarter roll on the trailer part, if you can believe the end scene. Okay, so you've got a crude oil spill that leaves a footprint, a burnt footprint out there. That never encroaches on the tractor. Mr. Tamez is in the tractor. He comes out of the tractor.
So what was the ignition source for the crude oil?
mean, there.
Probably the first fire, which started at the tractor.
But again, what's the methodology? The only eyewitness testimony, within seconds, they're both on fire. Now, what is the methodology that allows an expert to say, this source started this, what was the ignition source? What methodology allows someone to pick this ignition source and not this?
Well, first of all, don't assume that, if you want to assume that the less likely ignition source is at the trailer, that doesn't forgive the fact that the Mack truck allowed diesel when it should not have. When it didn't have to, when it was economically feasible to do otherwise.
That's why I asked you, are we down to the ignition source? Now what you're saying seems to be saying it doesn't matter where the ignition came from, as long as diesel spilled, there's a defect.
Well, I think that wasn't our argument. Our argument was that the battery was the ignition source. But that doesn't mean that there aren't other constructions or interpretations of this scene that wouldn't also implicate the Mack truck.
Are you saying that, I guess I need to be very clear about this, is the truck defective simply because diesel fuel spilled during a crash?
We think it was a compound defect, and that's our position, our first position, that the battery should never have been placed. It should have been separated from fuel because it provides ignition.
Okay, so you do need to prove that the battery was the source of the ignition for your theory to work.
I don't think I have to prove that. I'm saying that's our primary position. We think that's what happened. All right? But if diesel was allowed to escape because of this inferior balance line between the dual tanks on the tractor, and if somehow the crude oil ignited before the tractor became inflamed in diesel fire, and the trailer was the ignition source because of this fire that occurred back there first, then the diesel fuel should not have lost, the tank should not have lost integrity, allowing them to be ignited by the trailer. Now, as I say, that's not our first position, but I think it is an arguable position, and the evidence fits it.
All right, now, I did not get that out of the briefing, and I'm going to suspect the other side's going to tell me that's never been in the case.
Well, I was only responding to
I understand.
Justice's question. I'm not saying that we took that position. It's not the position we took. But if one were to look at it that way, it still implicates the Mack track.
Well, but you've got to land at some point. And I share my colleague's concern here. It seems to me very clear from your brief. You say, by Mack truck's design, the source of combustible diesel fuel is located inches away from the battery. And your theory, as I take it, that Judge Benalis was ruling on, was whether this battery started the fire, basically.
Well, let me hedge just a little if I may. Okay. We were looking at the most likely cause of ignition. That's not to say that we excluded, for instance, the hot surface of the engine or the exhaust manifold, all of which can become implicated in these kinds of fires. But when the battery is located 3 inches from the fuel tank, and later, after the Robinson hearing, Mack produces a photograph that they had and did not give to us, showing that the battery cable is welded to the metal of the truck, then that indicates that's a pretty good.
Mr. Elwell testified that one source of ignition was the hot engine.
Was the what?
Was the hot engine.
Yes.
And my sense of that was that if that's true, if he can't rule that out, then on the theory that you presented to Judge Benalis, you lose. Is that that's not your position?
No, it's not our position. I think Mr. Elwell was trying to give the trial court feel for what he thought was the most likely occurrence without saying that there was that the Mack tractor was otherwise fault free. But the point here is that you, number one, you separate fuel from ignition sources as best you can. Secondly, you put that fuel in a container that is least likely to lose integrity in the event of an accident such as this one.
Are you alleging in this case that the truck was defective because the diesel tanks were not designed the way they should be?
We certainly say that there shouldn't be this garden hose type arrangement to allow the two tanks to communicate.
If the battery had been located exactly where you think it should have been located and couldn't have been an ignition source, are you still claiming that just the fuel tank in and of itself was a product defect?
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, you can't lose fuel in a hot environment unless you're sure that you are shielding that fuel from those hot ignition sources that exist all over the track.
This is what I'm having trouble. That's not the impression I got from your briefing as to what your theory was.
Well,
and we're trying to figure out what the trial court had in front of it, what you said at the trial court was your theory.
Well, Mr. Elwell talked about other hot, other ignition points on the tractor. We do believe, because the evidence seems so compelling, that it was the battery that was the ignition source. But that doesn't excuse Mack from putting together fuel tanks that have no integrity whatsoever and that are going to spill.
Well, so under that theory, it doesn't matter if under your theory, if there's diesel on the ground, the fire could have started first in the tank and then ignited the diesel, it's still a defect. So what difference does it make where the fire started first?
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I'm following the question.
Let me rephrase it. I thought what I now hear you're saying is that as long as there's diesel fuel on the ground, basically, that it doesn't matter whether the fire started in the cab or in the trailer, because as long as there's diesel on the ground and the tanker started on fire first and then it ignited the diesel fuel, Mack is still liable. So it doesn't really matter where the fire started first.
Well, I've never taken that position, not today or in my briefing. I'll say again that our primary thrust was that the battery was the ignition source and the fuel tank was poorly designed because they were unable to contain fuel in what was a relatively nonviolent accident.
So it's a combination theory?
Well, yes. We pointed to two defects, but that's not to say that it's okay if you allow your tanks to lose integrity when they shouldn't in a hot environment, because ignition sources can be found all over that tractor.
Counsel, your 16 minutes has expired, so you're working into your co-counsel's time.
Was that my 16 plus the four?
You got some extra time. You got 8 extra minutes, so it has been 16, but there's still about 12 minutes left.
Okay. If I may, to say that the fire triangle is not a methodology is bewildering to me. If you're looking for, we know that fires don't occur without ignition, fuel, and oxygen's always there. Fuel was in both segments of this trailer. For Mr. Elwell to say, let's look for likely ignition sources and see if we can take that factor that wasn't necessarily present at both points on this rig and see if we find ignition sources capable of igniting either of these fuels, and if so, in proximity to these fuels in such a way that it's likely that it happened. To say that that's not a methodology for players. It is a methodology. It is a methodology that all arson investigators follow. So I will end with that.
Let me ask you about the abuse of discretion, the procedural aspect, and it's a question I pose to your opposing counsel. How can it be an abuse of discretion? What guiding principle tells us, or can we look at from a prior opinion of ours or from some rule that says the trial court must allow a second Daubert hearing after the conclusion of the first?
Well, I'll take an example from this case that I think would be supportable. It may not give you the best general rule to announce to the state of Texas, but in this case, the challenge by Mack wasn't as to the methodology per se or the data and the physical evidence on the ground. In fact, they avoided that fastidiously in their long cross-examination of Mr. Elwell. They never wanted to talk about the footprints left by the two different fuels. They never wanted to talk about crude oil never encroaching the tractor area where Mr. Pamez was consumed by fire.
So if we say that, then we say the trial court abused its discretion because Mack didn't inquire into methodology.
Mack essentially gave Elwell his due on his methodology and tried to pin him with the Maryland and O'Day study, which I think he did quite a good job of answering.
But what I'm trying to find out is why did the trial court have no discretion but to permit and to consider the evidence after the conclusion of the first hearing?
Well, first of all, understand that that proposition has arisen in this case, not at our instance. It arises from the fact that Mack has raised the issue because of a phrase in the Court of Appeals. I don't think the Court of Appeal, and Mack acknowledges that it makes no difference. The same evidence was presented in Robinson as in the bill, but if the court is looking for guidance as to when the challenged party should be allowed to be reheard, I would say in this case that that Mack used and but never proved up, never
offered. You keep going to substance. We're just looking procedurally. Let's just suppose Mack didn't say a word at the Daubert hearing. The trial court said, show up, give me your best shot, and at the end of the day, the trial court said, I don't think you get there. I'm going to exclude your witness. Now, what standard, if any, should we apply when you come back, show up at a later date, say, Judge, I've got my witness again, I want another shot at it? What standard should we apply?
I think a good starting point would be to make the challenging party set out in, as though it was a pleading, set out in writing exactly how they're going to challenge this person. Because this challenge went off on an issue that no one was expecting, that no one was forewarned about an article called the Maryland Study, primarily, that we think has no relevance.
Well, did you ask for a motion for continuance?
No, but we objected to them using that study.
You said, Judge, we need more time. Can we come back? I mean, we're just trying to figure out procedurally how you get through this.
And perhaps your co-counsel can explore that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Let me go ahead and start with that question. We are not complaining. Never complained at the Court of Appeals level. And are not complaining now or contending now that the trial court had a duty to conduct a motion for reconsideration of our Daubert defense. We did not say in the Court of Appeals that the trial court abused its error by failing to reconsider that point. That was not our point on appeal.
So if the Court of Appeals relied on evidence that appears only in the reconsideration, then they applied the wrong standard of review.
Wrong, but I'm very glad you asked, because that's, I think, one of two confusions I'd like to clarify. Here's why that issue came. Here's why that comes up. First of all, I do not believe that the Court of Appeals relied on any evidence that was not part of our original Daubert motion.
Assume they did.
But assume that they did. Here's why they actually must. We're here on a motion for summary judgment. Because we're here on a motion for summary judgment, which was filed after our Daubert motion was their Daubert motion was granted, we had a duty to try to put forth the evidence that we would put forth upon our response to the motion for summary judgment. We understood that the judge was not overly impressed with that motion at the hearing.
Well, let me ask you, the trial court could have entered a scheduling order at the outset and said, okay, all your experts, everything's to be done by date certain, and then we're going to have a Daubert hearing.
Yes.
And so you better have it in a row, because if you don't, that's the drop-dead deadline. After this hearing, no more from this expert.
Absolutely.
So why couldn't he do that by an order on motion of counsel to exclude this witness? And you're on notice, I better get it in, because if I don't, the judge is going to exclude my witness. Now, didn't you understand that the witness, or not, that the witness was going to be excluded in that proceeding for all purposes when the judge made his ruling?
We had absolutely no dispute that the trial court had the discretion to rule on the admissibility of this expert's testimony at that hearing. No question.
For all purposes.
For all purposes, but recall there was not the motion for summary judgment.
Including, but that's my question. Even including a subsequent motion for summary judgment, doesn't the trial court have the discretion to order the trial, the pretrial proceeding, say, okay, I'm going to rule, and then that's it. You don't get this witness.
No dispute, Your Honor. No dispute. The judge has that discretion under the Texas law as it stands right now. I don't dispute that one bit. We did not dispute that in the appellate court either. What we do say is this, is that if we are going to appeal our motion for summary judgment granted against us, we will need to allow the Court of Appeals to make two separate decisions. One, should the trial court have considered Mr. Elwell's testimony? That's kind of what we're talking about, some about why we believe it was error to exclude him. And then two, as a separate question, had the trial court considered Mr. Elwell's testimony, would it have made a difference in this case? And so the Court of Appeals is not only being asked, did Mr. Elwell, was he improperly excluded? And then if they say yes, we go home and get a chance to try our case. Matt Trucks may have an argument that, well, hey, wait a second, even if this guy wasn't properly excluded, you guys still didn't meet the burden to prevail on summary judgment. So what we had to do to be confident that we could prevail is say, this guy is wrong when he excluded our testimony, and had he not, the summary judgment should not have been granted.
On what basis? How can you say the trial court should not have excluded this testimony if you just agreed or said you agreed that, or said that the trial court has the absolute right to preclude any evidence from that expert at the conclusion of a Robinson hearing?
Oh, I guess I'm sorry. What I'm trying to say is that the trial court, I think, does not. What I was trying to say is that I don't think the trial court has any duty under Texas law. I don't think there are any guidelines that suggest under this circumstance the judge absolutely must conduct a motion for reconsideration, and under this circumstance he need not. I don't think there are any guidelines currently under Texas
law. Why does he have to look at the bill of exception?
Why does the trial court have to look
at it? Yes.
Oh, he doesn't. What I'm trying to say is this, Your Honor. In the Court of Appeals may have a question. The Court of Appeals may, in response to an argument made by Mack Trucks, the Court of Appeals might conclude, hey, you know what? We agree that Mr. Elwell should have been allowed to testify, but you know what? We just don't think he gets you there. And so as a consequence, we have to have, as part of our appellate record, not only the part of the proceedings where Mr. Elwell was stricken improperly, in our view, but we also have to have that part of the record ready, that part of the summary judgment response that says, and by the way, if you will let him testify, here's what he will testify to, and that testimony will get us by the motion for summary judgment.
Okay, let me ask you,
yes?
Beyond the procedural point, what evidence do you point to that would show the cab is the more likely ignition source than the trailer?
Okay, let me start with that, and then let me also address, because there are some questions about the, maybe you don't get the impression or this impression from reading our brief, and I think that touches on that issue. If you get the impression from our brief...
No, I just...
Okay, what evidence? I'm sorry.
Presuming that the ignition source is determinative. And I understand you're saying it's not, but let's presume that you need to show an ignition source to make the expert reliable.
Okay.
What evidence is there that it more likely originated in the cab than in the trailer?
The fire triangle analysis that Mr. Elwell applied essentially goes like this.
I understand the fire triangle.
Well, I mean, here's the physical evidence that he looked at.
I want to know the physical evidence.
The physical evidence that
it originated there.
First, we have the undisputed defect testimony. And again, the reason why we don't talk very much about the problem with the gas tanks is that's defect.
I understand.
And that's not disputed.
We have testimony that there's a defect.
Right. So what we have is, and again, to prove this fire triangle, we have to have the fuel source, the oxygen, which is in the air, and then the source of ignition. The fuel source is this.
Well, but Let's say you got the fire triangle theory on the cab.
Okay.
That indicates it could have started there. You got the fire triangle theory on the trailer because you got the same factors there. What do you have to show that this fire triangle happened more likely than that fire triangle?
Okay, what we have is this fire triangle being more likely than that fire triangle is that, first of all, we have Mr. Tanez, who is, again, this is one of these trucks where the tank is literally right there and the battery is literally right there. You could step on it getting into the truck. He's that close to that source. He's that close to that ignition source. We have the fact that 3 inches away, we have one source, and again, our defect is on the tanks.
But
our fire source, again...
I understand there are two possible sources.
Right.
And what evidence is there that it originated with one as opposed to the other? Because you got those same things in the tank.
Right. Well, the source is this. We're not claiming, and I want to clarify this, we're not claiming that trucks shouldn't have batteries. And we're not claiming that trucks...
Again, you're talking defect. Let's presume the
exactly.
cab's defective. Let's presume the cargo's defective. How can you tell which one caused it?
Here's the thing. Which one burned Mr. Tanez to death is the issue. If, for example, and what we're saying is that defect-wise, there should not be a spill of diesel fuel. So if diesel fuel is what burned Mr. Tanez to death, whether it was he was smoking a cigarette, there's no evidence of that, but whether he was smoking a cigarette and that's how that diesel fuel burned him to death, whether it was sparks from rubbing a metal truck on the ground.
So you're saying the ignition source doesn't matter?
The ignition source is very much an aggravating factor to what is a defective tank design. But the ignition source does not matter. Here's what matters. Here is what matters. And this is what the trial court focused on, and this is what Mr. Elwell focused on. Not so much the ignition source, but did he burn with crude on him, or did he burn with diesel on him? Because if the defect, if the fuel system, this is a fuel system integrity case, not a complaint about the tanker, it's a fuel system integrity case. If he burned from having diesel on him, then that is our complaint. If he burned from having crude on him, then we lose. That was the fight before the trial court. Not, hey, did it start because he was smoking a cigarette, or did it start because of the battery, or did it start because of the sparks?
Well, and that's why the questioning has been so directed to that. I didn't get that from the briefing. From the briefing, my assumption has always been that the issue depends on where the fire started.
No. It's where the fuel started. Where the fuel started. Where did which fuel got on to Mr. Tanner? Because it's our theory that the fuel system should not have leaked.
Which issue was presented to the trial judge as being the issue on which causation was being disputed at the Robinson hearing? That's the question.
Did he
what
burn
was presented to,
death to
the trial judge?
Of crude burns or diesel burns? That was the issue to
That's
the trial.
What the record of the Robinson hearing is going to show.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Was there a motion to exclude filed?
A motion to exclude?
The expert.
Yeah. Oh, yes, there was.
And a response.
Yes, there was.
And then record of the hearing.
Absolutely.
All right, let me just ask you, if that's the case, why does the fire triangle theory even matter?
The fire triangle theory even matters because, again, the triangle is oxygen, a given.
But if we don't care about the source.
No, it's the fuel source. That's why the fire triangle matters. Is it oxygen, source of ignition,
well, you'd be
source
having
of fuel?
Summary judgment on that. Nobody disputes that there was fuel on the ground. And I don't see it even hotly disputed that Mr. Tanez was covered with diesel fuel.
Exactly. You don't hear
so
it hotly disputed on appeal.
So why did the trial court exclude all this?
Pardon
me? Why did Judge Benales exclude all this?
Judge Benales excluded all of this because he did not believe that we showed that it was the fuel from the tanker, not fuel from the crude, which burned Mr. Tanez to death. He said we failed to prove that, not whether or not it was sparks or whether or not it was the battery. He said we failed to prove it was diesel versus crude. That's what we're saying. Well, wait a second. We filled that analytical gap, to the extent there is any, with Reverend Harrell's testimony. That filled that gap. You will see when you look at the record that the dispute at the trial court was whether or not we proved it was the crude or the diesel that burned Mr. Tamez. I believe that we did fill that analytical gap, and that's what the Court of Appeals concluded.
Are there any further questions?
Just one quick question. Yeah. About the procedural thing. Do you concede the trial court did not abuse its discretion by refusing to hold this second hearing?
Absolutely, we concede the trial court did not abuse its discretion under Texas current law. I believe that under Texas current law, the trial court absolutely has the discretion to say, hey, look, I've already heard this once, I don't care to hear it again.
Yeah, but your position is that the no evidence summary judgment motion, that it was bound to consider what was offered in the bill of exception on causation.
I don't know that the trial court was bound to consider it, but we were certainly bound to prove up our record. And the Court of Appeals appropriately looked at what we wished to prove.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the Court, Your Honor, I know I've already overstepped the bounds on time. It's the first time around, so I'll try to keep this as brief as possible. First of all, I respectfully disagree with the respondents now in their attempt to characterize the Robinson hearing as something about what was the source of the fuel that burned Mr. Tamez. The question there was the source of the fire. It's repeated throughout. Was it in the did it originate in the cargo, or did it originate somewhere in the cab? And respondents today have shown you that there's multiple areas the fire could have originated.
Well, let me ask you this. If, I understand it's a big if, but if they did plead a fuel system integrity case, and if fire origination was just an alternative part of their theory, I understand you're saying that's absolutely not the case, but if it were, would the trial court here have abused its discretion in striking this witness just as to the source of the fuel?
No, Your Honor, he would not have, and they haven't shown an abuse of discretion. They hadn't even argued that here on either of the points. In fact, I think they conceded the first one, procedural. There was no abuse of discretion in the trial judge not letting them have a second bite at the apple.
No, but at the first one, at the first hearing, there was the witness statement, wasn't there?
Right. His opinion was unreliable regardless of why they were trying to offer it.
Your Honor, but I mean...
If you're asking me, did Judge Benales abuse his discretion in striking Mr. Elwell's opinion? To me,
if their only theory was fuel fed, regardless of ignition source.
No, Your Honor. And it touched on the reason that you and I talked on before is that it was pure speculation. Just as when you talked about somebody being on the scene seconds after this occurred, actually they have corrected that in a corrected brief. It's minutes after the accident occurred. It's pure speculation. In fact, the witness testified to it as speculation as to what was on Mr. Tamez. And mind you, Judge, you and I are talking a big if.
Your expert, or their expert, did not know whether diesel was on him or not.
Correct.
And had nothing to add to him. So striking their expert had nothing to do with whether there was diesel on this fellow.
Absolutely, you are correct, Judge. It had everything to do with what the thrust of the issue was right before trial. Is the battery too close to the fuel tanks? Was that the source of ignition? In fact, Mr. Holmes, the second expert that was struck that they don't complain about, that's what he was testifying to also, the battery. That was the crux of the issue. Your Honor, you asked me before, and I neglected to give you a better answer in terms of why I think there's evidence in the bill of exception that's important to consider. There's three reasons I'll tell you why we know there had to be different evidence in the bill of exception. One, you read the record yourself, not meaning that flippantly, but anybody who reads it themselves can see, the 9 pages versus 60-plus. Two, if the Court of Appeals hadn't relied on that evidence, why were they mentioning it? Why were they looking at it? Three, respondents themselves said, we have to put this on, Judge. We concede that we didn't do enough, meaning my expert didn't do enough the first time. So they have conceded on the record that their first offer by their expert wasn't enough to get past a Daubert hearing. And four, more importantly, if you look at, for instance, just a few of the categories, witness statements and depots, only Harold mentioned in the first. There's others in the bill of exception. DPS report, nothing in the first. Bill, or in the first hearing, it's in the second bill of exception. Physical inspection of scene, only minute description in the first hearing. There's more extensive description in the second. Photos of the burned vehicle, nothing marked or offered in the first hearing, but was in the second.
Well, again, procedurally, you say they had the hearing, the witness was excluded. Then did they file any kind of formal motion for reconsideration?
They made an oral motion for reconsideration.
At the summary judgment hearing.
Yes, Your Honor.
So no 3 days notice?
Well, there wasn't a complaint about it, so I should tell you I'm not 100% that they didn't file a written notice to say it. I will tell you, when you read the record, Justice Owen, you'll know the trial judge was like, what in the world? I've done this one time before. That's when he asked Respondents' Counsel, aren't you just asking for a second bite at the apple? And they said, yes, we are. We shouldn't give litigants a second bite on a Robinson challenge. It's bad public policy. We ask this court to reverse the 13th Court.
But you do agree that if the expert should have been admitted or should have not been excluded at this first hearing, then once you get to summary judgment or maybe a better example, trial, you're entitled to improve your expert at that point in time.
Well, subject to the rules, Your Honor.
Right. So, if we say that judge was wrong, that this person should have been excluded, then whatever extra he says at trial or extra in a summary judgment affidavit that occurs after the hearing should be considered for the purposes of whether there's any evidence.
Summary judgment
should be granted.
I would agree with you with this caveat, that there are stringent rules about, quote-unquote, improving your expert. A lot of people try to do it on the eve of trial, and some guy comes in and surprises you with whole different things. That's not what happened here. Okay? The complaint by Mack to Judge Benales wasn't, hey, we agree, we think you ought to exclude this guy because he's surprising us. Okay? That's different. Mack's complaint was, this expert witness ought to be excluded because he doesn't have the methodology he should, and he hasn't ruled out the causes with reasonable certainty. Those two reasons, there was no abuse of discretion in Judge Benales' striking.
Let me see if I can make clearer your position on the second hearing. Looking at your brief, it looks like you're saying the Court of Appeals erred from your perspective because its opinion essentially requires a trial judge to have a second hearing. Okay. Is that correct so far?
Yes, I agree with you.
But you don't object to the trial judge having discretion to have a second hearing, and the trial judge exercised that discretion in this case. So
correct.
In this case, you don't object to what the trial judge did. You object to the effective rule of law you believe the Court of Appeals created.
Yes, with one clarification. He did not hold a second hearing. He refused to hold a second hearing, which was his discretion. They then made a bill of exception. So,
which sounds like was a second hearing.
Well, it wasn't a hearing, Judge. It's a bill of exception. It's different because he doesn't rule on it at the end as if he did the first time.
I've been a trial judge, and I've had many bills before.
Right.
And I know how they work. You're saying the trial judge did not consider the live testimony, cross-examination, and additional evidence that you've just gone through in that bill?
That's what I'm saying, Judge, and we know that because he said, you can make a bill if you want to, but I'm not giving you a second hearing.
So he didn't make a ruling after that bill?
I can't tell you 100% as I stand here if he made a ruling on it. I do know 100%, Justice, that what he said was, I don't have to give you a second hearing. I'm not giving you a second hearing. You can make a bill if you want to. So, in effect, he didn't give him a second hearing, but the Court of Appeals did.
Although, if there's a ruling after the second hearing, if you will, in the record, that would suggest that he did.
Perhaps, but I don't believe there is, Judge.
Okay.
I think it's very clear from the record he declined to do so, which was within his discretion.
Thank you, Counsel. That concludes the second argument. The Court will take another brief recess.